with disturbing frequency, acts of terrorism have indicated the vulnerability of each of us to attack. It's easier not to think about that. But there are people who think about it professionally, authorities on the subject. Brian Jenkins is among them. He's an historian and director of research on international terrorism for the RAND Corporation. He is also author of International Terrorism, A New Mode of Conflict. The subject, Terrorism, A New Dimension of Power. Brian Jenkins.
I want you to think about some recent headlines, perhaps some things that you saw when you turned on your television sets in the past several weeks. In New York, 100,000 people evacuate major office buildings. Trading on one of the commodities exchanges is interrupted. The costs of the disruption for the single day are put in the tens of millions of dollars. In West Germany, state visits are canceled. The entire cabinet meets. Representatives of all political parties and the prime ministers of several German states attend. The prime minister of the Federal Republic takes personal command of a special crisis team. Meanwhile, barbed wire, sentry boxes, and sandbagged gun emplacements are thrown up around government buildings and the homes of political leaders. Armored cars and police armed with submachine guns take up positions at street corners around the capital. For a while, the government is virtually paralyzed. Its success or failure in dealing with the crisis, political observers say, will determine the future political climate of the country. In Japan, the cabinet also meets in crisis. Here, too, the government is temporarily paralyzed. A decision is made to yield. This has happened before. Released prisoners are flown to the scene, where in the midst of an exchange, a revolt breaks out. And although the incident ends without tragedy, many criticize the Japanese government for its decision to capitulate. Japan's Minister of Justice resigns. In each of these three cases, the crisis I've described here, which, as I say, you saw in headlines, saw on your television sets, was caused not by a national emergency of some sort, not a state of imminent war, not a coup d'etat nor an insurrection, but rather by incidents of terrorism. In the first case, a series of bombings and bomb threats in New York. In the second case, by the kidnapping of a prominent business executive and subsequently the hijacking of a West German airliner. And in the third, by the hijacking of a Japan Airlines plane. Well, such incidents have become common in recent years. Repeatedly during the last few years, small groups have demonstrated that by using terrorist tactics, they can achieve disproportionate effects. They can attract worldwide attention to themselves and to their causes. They arouse worldwide alarm. They can create international incidents that national governments are compelled to deal with, often before a worldwide audience. To protect against their attacks or to respond to the crisis situations they create, they force governments to expend resources vastly out of scale with the magnitude of the actual threat they posed. Well, this increased use of terrorist tactics over the past decade, in my view, reflects some fundamental changes in the nature of political power, which will have important consequences for society and government. And it is these I would like to address tonight. There are numerous definitions of terrorism. Let me describe terrorism here simply as the use of actual or threatened violence to gain attention and to create an atmosphere of fear and alarm, which in turn will cause people to exaggerate the strength of the terrorists and the importance of their cause. And since most groups that use terrorist tactics are typically small and weak, the violence they must practice must be deliberately shocking. Terrorism is thus violence for effect, not necessarily for the physical effect on the target itself. Indeed, the targets of the terrorist attack, the actual victims of a terrorist attack, may be trivial, may be secondary to the objectives they seek. The people watching are the primary targets of the terrorist attack. And we see numerous examples when terrorist attacks are almost, we might say, choreographed. Choreographed to achieve maximum publicity. Terrorists often take hostages, for example, to deliberately increase the drama by placing human life in a balance. Terrorism, in that sense, is a form of theater. And, you know, to describe how the theory works, I recall a play that I saw several years ago in New York. I forget what most of the play was about. It was a series of silly episodes. It wasn't a Broadway production. It was put on by a small radical underground theater group, and the audience at the theater was much smaller than the audience here tonight. But I do recall one episode in particular. At one point in the play, all of the actors and actresses dressed in black leotards came out on a stage such as this one and lined up in front of the audience. And the first actor took out a glass mason jar, unscrewed the lid, reached in, took out a live butterfly, held it up for the audience to see, and released it. And a butterfly flew off somewhere into the stage lights. The second actor in the row did the same thing, took out a glass mason jar, unscrewed the lid, reached in, took out a live butterfly, held it up, and released it. And this one flew out into the audience. The third actor began to do the same thing, took out a glass jar, reached in, took out a live butterfly, lit a match, and burned the butterfly in front of the audience. Now think about that for a moment. Think about the shock, the revulsion at this senseless act of violence, a trivial act of violence to be sure, the life of one insect. We all occasionally swat flies, I suppose. But choreographed in such a way, set up in such a way to cause shock among the audience. And it worked. The people in the front row were ready to leap up on the stage and strangle the individual who burned the butterfly. Had they passed a hat in the audience that night to take up a collection for this butterfly's life, I have no doubt that they could have raised $1,000. The point of the story is, if you keep that story in mind, you begin to get at the fundamental theory of how terrorism works. Instead of the lives of insects, the lives of human beings, placed in a balance, in a deliberately choreographed, deliberately dramatized situation, demands placed upon the audience watching, designed to achieve the shock and this effect which expands the importance of the whole event. Well, the concept itself is an old one. The actual term terrorism entered the political lexicon almost 2 centuries ago during the French Revolution, but the idea is much older than that. But international terrorism, as we see it today, is a relatively recent invention, the product of a confluence of recent political and technological developments. Contemporary technology has provided terrorists with new targets and new capabilities. Take jet air travel, for example. It gives them both dramatic targets and unprecedented mobility that allows them to strike almost anywhere in the world. Again, recall the Lod Airport massacre of May 1972, in which Japanese terrorists, recruited in Japan, met Palestinian terrorists, North Korea, formed an alliance, then Japanese terrorists fly to the Middle East to get some additional training, go to one European country to pick up their weapons, go to another European country to board an aircraft, fly that aircraft to Lod Airport in Israel, get off that plane and begin machine-gunning passengers, most of whom turn out to be Puerto Rican pilgrims on their way to the Holy Land. If that isn't the case of international terrorism, I don't know what the hell is. That is made possible by the tremendous mobility that we have in the world today. A second important technological development are the developments that have taken place in communications in recent years. In particular, here I'm talking about radio, television, communication satellites, the kinds of things that make it possible to broadcast the dramatic incidents of violence that terrorists are capable of creating almost instantaneously throughout the entire world. The tremendous capability to reach a worldwide audience. And if you think of terrorism, as I tend to do, as a form of theater, a violent form of theater to be sure, but a form of theater, then the ability to reach an audience of several hundred million provides the terrorists with a tremendous amount of leverage and power. A third development are the vulnerabilities arising from modern society's increasing dependence on technology, new forms of technology, in some cases fragile systems, in some cases quite vulnerable systems. I mentioned one already, civil aviation. Looking at it from one point of view, a modern 747 jet is a masterpiece of modern technology, a theater of people that flies. Looking at it from the terrorist point of view, it's a tin can filled with 350 hostages at 39,000 feet. Other vulnerabilities that recently have come in for a great deal of discussion in this country are the vulnerabilities inherent as a country becomes more dependent on nuclear power, with increasing traffic in fissionable material and radioactive waste material, and the possibilities that this may afford political extremists in the future. A fourth development are the developments in new weapons that are increasing the small group's capacity for violence. When I say weapons developments here, I'm not talking about the tremendous weapons developments we've seen since World War II, major weapon systems such as intercontinental ballistic missiles, nuclear weapons, nuclear submarines, things of this sort. I'm talking about the perhaps less dramatic but no less important developments that have taken place in the area of individual weaponry. Small packages of explosives with miniaturized detonating devices, kinds of things that make a letter bomb possible. So a handheld precision-guided weapons, which I'll talk more about in a moment. These things that increase the individual's capacity for violence. These are the technological developments that have provided terrorists with these new capabilities. The political circumstances that led to the development of the tactics of international terrorism include three. First, I would mention the failure of the rural guerrilla movements in Latin America and the movement of guerrilla warfare into the cities of Latin America in the late 1960s. You'll recall that following the victory of Fidel Castro in Cuba, there was a proliferation throughout Latin America of rural guerrilla movements in Guatemala, in Brazil, in Bolivia, in other countries in Latin America. But by the tail end of the 1960s, it was quite apparent that the Cuban model revolution could not easily be duplicated elsewhere. As a result, the revolutionary groups began to turn their attention to the cities where they could be ensured of attracting worldwide attention. And they quite naturally turned to the dramatic tactics, the dramatic terrorist tactics, bank robberies, seizing hostages, first their own government officials, and later foreign diplomats to bring in the international community. So that would be one. The second one would be the stunning military victory of the Israelis in the Six-Day War in 1967, which caused the Palestinians to abandon their dependence on Arab military power to achieve their aims and to rely more heavily on the tactics of terrorism with the approval and support of Arab governments. The third I would point to, the third root, political root of modern terrorism, would be the widespread anti-Vietnam War and anti-government demonstrations in the universities of Western Europe, Japan, and the United States. To be sure, by no stretch of the imagination could the anti-war protest movements, could the anti-government movements be called acts of terrorism. People were exercising their rights to protest. But historically, these mass protest movements spawned on their extremist fringes small groups that were dedicated to carrying on a struggle by violence even after the student movements had subsided. And so emerging from the demonstrations of West Germany in the late 1960s was the Bader-Meinhof gang and the June 2nd group. Emerging from the mass demonstrations in Tokyo in the late 1960s was the United Red Army in Japan. Emerging from the protest movements in this country were our own domestic small groups, the Weather Underground, the New World Liberation Front, the Red Dawn, the Red Guerrilla Family, and other of the small groups. Once the tactics of terrorism were developed, of course, and their utility demonstrated and displayed worldwide, a feat made possible by the concurrent developments in mass communications, then they in turn provide inspiration and instruction for other groups, and terrorism became a kind of self-perpetuating phenomenon. Well, let's think about that for a moment. What really are the major sources of the terrorist power today? First, it is the value, the high value, that society places on human life. Faced with the option, faced with any sort of an option, governments are extremely reluctant to allow hostages to be killed, despite, in many cases, popular pressure that a line must be drawn, that the thing must stop here. governments are extremely reluctant to have people killed, to have the blood on their hands. So the tremendous value we place on human life, and certainly I would not argue for the contrary, is one of the vulnerabilities in our society, and a vulnerability that terrorists can exploit, and one which gives them tremendous power. That terrorists recognize and exploit this can be seen in the frequency with which terrorists use the tactic of seizing hostages. Indeed, approximately a third of all incidents of international terrorism involve taking hostages by hijacking airliners, taking over embassies, or kidnapping individuals. Terrorists seize hostages, whether diplomats, corporate executives, tourists, sometimes just anybody handy, to deliberately heighten the drama of the episode by placing human life in the balance and thereby increasing their own leverage. In return for the release of hostages, terrorists have received millions of dollars in cash. In one single episode in Argentina, they received $60 million. I want to point out that that is equivalent to one-third of that country's national defense budget. They've gotten military aid in return for hostages. They've got financing for various philanthropic enterprises, such as distributions of food and clothing to the poor. They've obtained the release of imprisoned comrades, won safe passage for themselves to other countries, and compelled governments to denounce treaties. A second source of the terrorist power is one which I've alluded to already, and that is free access to the media, which does enable them to reach a worldwide audience, thus magnifying the seeming importance of their actions. This is by no means an argument for censorship. It's the price we pay for having a free press, and it is a recognition of a vulnerability in a free society. And I tend to regard the media, particularly the electronic media, as a vulnerability in the same way that I regard civil aviation as a vulnerability. We certainly can stop airline hijackings by grounding all airliners. So we can still stop terrorist access to the media by censoring all the media. But that is not the point. This is a tremendous tool for our society, is a tremendous benefit for our society. And in order for that to work in a free society, access must be unlimited at both ends, both the people making the news and the people in the audience. But it is a vulnerability. A third source of terrorist power, particularly those who operate internationally, is the historically unprecedented respect shown in the world today for the concept of national sovereignty, even for the sovereignty of those nations that provide sanctuary and aid terrorists. In another era, I suppose, nations victimized by terrorists operating from abroad probably would have reacted militarily. Again, this is not a call for a return to the gunboat diplomacy of the 19th century, but simply a recognition that gunboats and punitive expeditions no longer have any place in the world, and groups can take advantage of this abiding by the rules. While it is easy to become somewhat overly alarmed about terrorism, I think it's important to point out that the actual amount of terrorist violence overall has been greatly exaggerated. Indeed, that is evidence of its success in gaining worldwide attention. But measured against the world volume of violence, terrorist violence is trivial. I don't mean to say that any death is not tragic, any death is not shocking, but let's look at the statistics here. Indeed, about 1,000 persons have died in international terrorist incidents since 1968. Another 2,000 or so have been injured. If we add the casualties of domestic political violence in places such as Belfast and Buenos Aires, then the total number of deaths may ascend to about 10,000 at the most. More than twice that number of people are murdered every year in the United States. The annual homicide rate in this country is approximately 20,000 people. And indeed, since 1968, 6 million people in the world have died in 13 wars. 6 million. So when we take these 1,000 deaths and we measure it against the world volume of violence, without sounding callous about the thing, it is trivial. But the important fact is not to keep in mind that it's trivial violence, but to keep this in perspective when talking about some of the draconian countermeasures that are called for to deal with the terrorists. Some of the final solutions that in themselves are more dangerous than the threat the terrorists themselves pose to society. Of course, it can be argued that terrorism is not appropriately measured by body counts, by property damage, but rather by the amount of attention it receives, by its ability to create these national and international crises. by the costs of protection against terrorist attacks, which are enormous, by the amount of alarm that terrorists create, and by the consequences these have for society. Terrorist tactics are calculated to rivet attention and to create alarm, and in this they succeed. The fundamental issue here is fear, and perhaps the biggest danger posed by terrorists lies not in the physical damage they do, but in the atmosphere of alarm they create, which corrodes democracy and breeds repression. Fortunately, thus far, the world has not come to that state, at least in most nations. In response to terrorism, legislation has produced a growing corpus of law to deal with politically motivated crimes, specifically acts of terrorism. In many cases, terrorism has been identified as a crime different from, and in most cases more serious than, the traditional crimes that terrorists commit: murder, kidnapping, arson. New criminal offenses, such as air piracy, have been identified. Many countries have extended their penal codes to cover crimes committed outside of the national territory, such as crimes aboard airliners. Legislation has broadened police powers. In some countries, trial procedures have been changed, generally to the accused's disadvantage. Often, measures adopted as temporary have become permanent, or at least have prevailed for far longer than their drafters had originally anticipated. Several nations have created committees or coordinating groups at the national level to coordinate national efforts against terrorists. New special anti-terrorist organizations have been created within police departments or within internal security organizations. Military participation in police functions has increased. Private security forces have grown tremendously. Special military units for possible use in anti-terrorist operations abroad are also being created. And if terrorism persists, it would not be surprising to see their use in the next decade. But while the measures enacted to combat terrorism have impeded free movement to a certain degree, subjected travelers to more scrutiny, and on occasion create a nuisance, we cannot say without some exaggeration that democracy has been imperiled by them. Authoritarian regimes have characteristically reacted with repressive measures. Nations with strong democratic traditions have cautiously limited certain liberties as the price of security. Civil libertarians argue, however, that these infringements, however small, are too high a price to pay for tranquility, and it is true that such measures tend to have a cumulative effect. And indeed, how quickly our society accustoms itself to them. If just 10 years ago I were to tell you, or indeed someone were to tell me, that before boarding the airplane that I took to fly here to attend this meeting tonight, that before boarding this airplane, my baggage would be x-rayed, my hand luggage would be searched, and I personally might be frisked, I would have been outraged by that. I would have been calling my lawyer. I would be talking about unlawful search and seizure. And yet, today, this is something we not only put up with, it is something we even welcome as a guarantee that the plane is going to go to the destination for which we bought the ticket. And we have ample reminders on our television screens that this is not always the case. But we don't live in airports. And we wouldn't particularly like to live in airports. And yet, in a place like Belfast, the entire downtown area of Belfast, a depressing place, has been turned into a huge airport. What I mean by that is that the city has been surrounded with fencing and checkpoints. And it is necessary, if one goes to downtown Belfast to buy groceries or to buy any sort of a thing, one is searched going in, going out, metal detectors are there, one is frisked, the packages are examined. This in a free society. So the consequences can be quite severe, and the unfortunate historical observation is that terrorism historically breeds repression. While the use of terrorist tactics has proved useful, as I've been emphasizing here, in getting publicity and occasionally obtaining some political concessions, few terrorist groups can claim to have achieved any of their long-range political objectives. And in that respect, terrorism is a failure. Indeed, it is hard to see how assassinations, how bombings, how kidnappings, how hijackings can be translated into the achievement of the terrorist objectives. Do Palestinians seriously expect Israel to accede to the creation of a Palestinian homeland because its planes are hijacked? Do South Moluccan terrorists think that the Dutch government can deliver them an independent Malacca? The answer is probably no. As I say, it does work for publicity, and by evidence of that, how many of you honestly had ever heard of South Malacca before the incidents that took place in the Netherlands? I had some idea that South Malacca must be somewhere south of North Malacca, which has exhausted my entire knowledge of the subject. But as I say, the answer is probably no. They don't really believe that the Dutch government can deliver them an independent Malacca. But it's important to look at it from the point of view. Terrorists often see themselves as the victims of solutions which the world has imposed upon them. The Palestinians, in their view, are dispossessed by a decision of the British to create a homeland for the Jews, by decisions made in the United Nations, by continued U.S. support for Israel, in sum, by a series of decisions made elsewhere. And thus the terrorist approach is to create, through the use of terrorist tactics, an intolerable situation that will compel the world to intervene and impose another solution that will be favorable to them. And that's important, to create an intolerable situation so that they cannot achieve victory themselves, but someone else will step in and impose a situation favorable to them. Terrorists fighting on behalf of independence movements or separatist causes hope to produce sufficient pain and expense to simply cause the central authority to give up and withdraw. Again, they do not win, but they simply prolong the struggle and hope that the other side will give up and go home. Revolutionary terrorists hope to create a situation that will simply make it impossible to govern. Thus, some terrorists don't expect to defeat their opponents. They expect their opponent to eventually quit or wear out, or some external power to come in and impose a solution on their opponent, or society to collapse. All they have to do is prolong the struggle. Well, what about the future? What trends are discernible now? I believe that the use of terrorist tactics will persist as a mode of political expression. As I say, all they have to do is prolong the struggle. It doesn't necessarily achieve them their long-range goals, but terrorists are typically short-sighted, and those who used or would use terrorist tactics are sufficiently encouraged by the occasional publicity, the occasional tactical victories, to preclude their abandonment of terrorist tactics. They see their goals in terms of short-range goals, and these are met. Among the other trends, I think it's safe to say that terrorists appear to be getting more sophisticated in their tactics, their weapons, and their exploitation of the media. Terrorists will remain highly mobile, able to strike targets anywhere in the world. Some of the new weapons being developed for military arsenals, such as shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, may find their way into the hands of terrorists. Indeed, this is perhaps one of the most frightening new developments. We are currently in the process, that is, the United States, the countries of Western Europe, the Soviet bloc countries, are currently in the process of developing and deploying a whole new range of weapons called man-portable precision-guided munitions, or PGMs. Now, what is a precision-guided munition? It is simply a weapon that enables you to correct the course of this weapon after it's left the barrel of the gun. In other words, hitting the target does not depend on how good of a shot you are. You can correct it after it leaves the barrel, or the projectile itself has something in its nose, a TV screen, an infrared heat-seeking device, that allows it to correct its own course. There's nothing particularly new about this technology. It's the same technology that enables us to land rocket ships on the moon. But what is new is, as a result of developments in the electronics industry, the components of these systems are becoming more and more miniaturized. And what could be put in an intercontinental ballistic missile can now be put in a weapon that is 3.5 feet long, weighs 30 pounds, and has a range of 1 to 3 kilometers and a hit probability approaching 1, meaning if you can see it, you can hit it. Now, it's not conjecture that such weapons will find their way into the hands of terrorists. Indeed, they already have. At the Rome airport several years ago, they arrested several Arab terrorists. They had in their possession the Soviet Strela missile, the SA-7. This is an infrared heat-seeking device, an infrared heat-seeking missile, shoulder-fired. Tracks the heat of an aircraft engine and literally flies right up the tailpipe and explodes inside inside the aircraft. These are now being deployed in the hundreds of thousands. By the end of the decade, these weapons will be available to not only the developed countries of the world, but to as many as 30 or 40 of the third world nations in the world. If we postulate even a conservative loss rate by diversion, by illegal sale, by theft of 0.1%, then these weapons will be loose in the hundreds by the end of the decade. That may be insignificant militarily, but we're not talking about their use against military targets. We're not talking about weapons being used against tanks or against tactical aircraft. We're talking about their use against civilian aircraft or moving cars in a presidential motorcade or hitting a speaker's podium from a distance of 1 to 3 kilometers. Terrorist groups appear to be strengthening their links with each other. One result is the emergence of multinational freelance terrorist groups that are willing to carry out attacks on behalf of causes they are sympathetic with, or to undertake specific operations or campaigns of terrorism on commission from client groups or governments. And finally, we see nations that are unwilling or unable to mount a conventional military challenge on the battlefield may adopt terrorist tactics or employ terrorist groups as a mode of surrogate warfare against other nations. Other trends that we can see today include the emergence, particularly in Western Europe, of a semi-permanent terrorist subculture composed of several generations of terrorists, plus their supporters, their sympathizers, their lawyers, their propagandists, their chroniclers, their groupies, all of whom are in some way dependent upon continued terrorist activity. One West German official has called it the terrorist scene. Within this subculture, terrorism is evolving from a set of tactics used to support an ideology into the ideology itself. The ism is terrorism. Now, this is a terribly significant development in terms of what terrorists may do in the future. Because previously, terrorist actions have always been, to a degree, constrained by the political considerations of not doing something that would alienate the perceived constituents of the terrorists. You don't poison the water supply in the name of the popular front and expect to remain popular for very long. And if we don't expect terrorists to make moral judgments, they do, at least we hope, make practical political judgments. There are upper limits, we hope, even on terrorism. But if we begin to think of a terrorist subculture, if we begin to think not of an external constituency of the terrorists, whether that is, quote, the people, or, quote, the workers, or some other perceived constituency, if instead the constituency becomes the terrorist subculture itself, the terrorists become their own constituency, then the constraints upon the actions are seriously eroded. And terrorists may do things to demonstrate that they can do them, or do things to see if they can be done. Terrorist actors play before an audience of other terrorists, and the possibilities for more serious violence are increased as the constraints are eroded. Another trend is the evolution of purely politically motivated terrorist groups into a more traditional form of criminal organization. While still maintaining a political veneer in many countries, the business of terrorism is becoming in some places a business. The IRA, for example, is heavily into extortion. It runs protection rackets, participates in defrauding insurance companies, and is also acquiring legitimate businesses, pubs and taxicab companies. One of Argentina's largest terrorist groups is reported to have built up a large stock portfolio with the ransoms it has collected. Today's terrorist groups may become tomorrow's mafias. That is not necessarily bad, by the way. At least I don't see it as necessarily bad. Because with the evolution from politically motivated activities into the more traditional areas of crime, there comes a certain conservatism. As opposed to in the first case, where we think about a terrorist subculture carrying out actions for the sake of carrying out those actions, in this case, we see actions carried out with a profit motive. And if there isn't any profit motive, one doesn't carry out the actions. One sees considerations of not alienating the public too much to bring too much heat down on the organization. So as they evolve into more criminal organizations like mafias, they may be dissuaded from some of the more serious acts that could otherwise be considered. Still another trend is the appearance of a new generation of Luddites, out to destroy the machinery of Western industrial society in the name of a vaguely leftist, anti-capitalist, humanist, anti-technology ideology. It's kind of a blend. We see this in certain areas, particularly in Europe, where the purely environmental anti-nuclear power movement has, in a sense, merged with the unenvironmental political radical movement. Political radicals fastening themselves on the mass demonstrations against nuclear power and operating according to their own agendas to use this enthusiasm and this protest as an instrument against the state. Nuclear power becoming a symbol of the state, a symbol of modern technology that is not wanted by everyone. We see it also in Italy, in a number of bombing attacks that we've seen in the past 12 months on data processing centers. Another symbol of modern society. What can we have as better symbols of modern industrial society than a nuclear reactor and a computer? Attacks on computer centers, bombing attacks with messages left behind that this computer center is training the tools of the capitalist state that must be destroyed, or that the two computers themselves are the instruments of a capitalist state. We see it also in terms of some conflicts between French university students and the government on the issue of curriculum, where the students are objecting to the increased emphasis being given business administration and scientific educational courses in the universities, and in their view, the consequent devaluing of a humanities degree. I share some sympathy with this, holding a humanities degree, but the point is that the French government sought to bring about these changes in order to reduce the number of graduates every year who graduate into the ranks of the unemployed with their humanities degrees, and it attempted to move more people into the sciences. But this provoked a tremendous reaction, violent demonstrations, even some bombings. Now, within this anti-nuclear power, and I'm not talking about the environmentalist anti-nuclear opposition. I'm not talking about that now. I'm talking about a political anti-nuclear movement. Within that, within the attacks on the computer processing centers, within these confrontations regarding the rejection of a more scientific or of a more business-oriented university curriculum, there is a common thread. And it is the common thread that modern society, modern industrial society, and modern government is becoming increasingly technological and increasingly inhuman. And as a result, people are being dehumanized. And the only way to fight back against this is to destroy this technology. Now, the idea of terrorism in the name of humanism may strike some as novel, but we do have some examples of this as a third trend. International terrorism is still a comparatively minor problem in the world, but I think the consequences of terrorism go far beyond anything yet accomplished by the terrorists or even contemplated by terrorists. The developments that have made international terrorism possible could eventually redefine war and compel us to alter our present concepts of security, of defense, and potentially of government itself. It seems that the equations of power are changing. Put terrorism into its historical perspective, and we see that as a result of new technology, as a result of these new vulnerabilities, as a result of new weapons, as a result of the invention and demonstration of these new tactics, power defined here in its most primitive sense as simply the capacity to destroy or to disrupt, is descending to smaller and smaller groups. Or to put it another way, that the small bands of political extremists, the irreconcilables, the fanatics, the lunatics that have always existed in society, have become an increasingly potent force to be reckoned with. The capacity for violence, once possessed only by organized military forces, is coming into the hands of gangs whose grievances, whether real or imaginary, it will not always be possible to satisfy. And that is going to have some important effects. One immediate effect we have already seen is the major diversion of resources into internal security functions. The protection of political leaders and diplomats, airports, nuclear facilities, and other vital systems is going to demand increasing manpower and money. I foresee the continuing growth of what we might call an internal defense budget. It won't appear as an internal defense budget, but it will be dispersed, because it will be dispersed among the budgets of various government agencies as well as in the security expenditures of private businesses. This seems to be part of a major shift in society from viewing security, traditionally, in terms of secure national frontiers, clearly a national responsibility, to the defense of what we might call inner perimeters, guarded facilities, airport perimeters, privately patrolled communities, security buildings, alarmed homes, where the burden of this kind of defense is increasingly placed upon local government, the private sector, and the individual citizen. Should terrorism persist, we may anticipate some of the security measures of a kind that are now in force at airports extended to other areas. The nature of this, of course, will depend on the future course of terrorist tactics. Further bombs aboard aircraft or in airline terminals could result in a routine X-raying of all baggage, not just a portion of it. Bombs in public buildings could result in some sort of screening process at entrances, similar to, but certainly more elaborate than the present routine check of identification cards and cursory search of briefcases and purses at certain federal office buildings. Increasingly, employees and visitors may be compelled to pass by metal detectors and explosive detecting devices and have all parcels examined. Identity cards may become more prevalent in our society. Various forms of clearances may become routine for an increasing portion of society. Armed private security guards are likely to become more ubiquitous. Buildings themselves will become more fortified. A friend of mine is an architect, and he recently participated in the designing of a major bank in the city of San Francisco, and he was bragging to me about this design. It was a beautiful design, at least on the surface of it. And he said, you know that this building is designed without any windows below the third floor. Now, he is designing for San Francisco area. California does have 25% of all the bombings in this country. But think of it. This bank is designed like a fortress to have no windows to be blown out below the third floor. We're talking about a building being turned into a medieval castle. Indeed, geographically, society in the future may become a series of separated or overlapping perimeters which people move through to work, travel, or visit. In a sense, a more medieval society. The only difference being is that the moats and the drawbridges and the porticulus are in more modern electronic form, but nonetheless a society of perimeters. Second consequence, it seems that national sovereignty seems to be eroding. This is not simply the result of terrorism. It's happening anyway. International financial organizations, multilateral economic institutions, such as the EEC and OPEC, and the multinational corporations have diminished the economic prerogatives of the state. The global dimension of the world's major problems, population growth, food, energy, pollution, all seem beyond the capacity of any single nation to solve. The proliferation of ethnic separatist movements around the world, many of them fielding small terrorist groups, are rejecting central authority. The earth itself is increasingly being subdivided. You know that since the end of World War II, the number of independent nations has tripled. By 1990, there will be 200, perhaps 250, independent nations in the world as governments are compelled to yield in front of a public audience to small bands of extremists. What magic of sovereignty is there left? And in the first case, in the case of being the primary unit for fighting wars, that also is changing. Nations do maintain their credentials in a last resort by maintaining their monopoly over the means of violence. But as the balance of military, that is destructive power, shifts away from national armies towards smaller armed groups that do not necessarily represent or confine their activities to any particular nation, the national governments may indeed lose their monopoly over the means of large-scale violence, and we may see the emergence of semi-permanent or permanent subnational and transnational entities. The world that emerges is an unstable collection of nations, mini-states, autonomous ethnic sub-states, governments in exile, national liberation fronts, guerrilla groups aspiring to international recognition and legitimacy, and a collection of ephemeral but disruptive terrorist organizations some of which are linked together in vague alliances, some perhaps the protégés of foreign states. A world of formal peace between nations, free, except for brief periods of open warfare, but of a higher level of political violence. Looking at it historically, a world not unlike the late Middle Ages or perhaps Renaissance Italy, in which we had kingdoms and various duchies and condottieri and warring cities going to war with other, and a style of diplomacy and a style of warfare that was far more fluid than that today. Where the questions remain, how a society reckoned with violent little groups that are trying to make it impossible to govern? How will the world deal with several hundred sovereign and semi-sovereign political entities? As political extremists invent new tactics and acquire new weapons, as society acquires new vulnerabilities, as extremists are able to project exaggerated power through mass communications, then these questions pose a unique challenge to democratic governments that try to govern by peaceful consensus. Thank you.
Brian Jenkins. After his address, Mr. Jenkins took questions from the audience. The first questioner wanted to know, how effective as a response to terrorism were the methods used by Israel in their raid at Entebbe Airport?
We have to think of success in different terms. In the case of the Entebbe raid, they were successful in a sense that they were faced with an impossible situation in which they are compelled to take some action, either yield to the demands and get the hostages out, or go in and rescue the hostages themselves. They did execute a boldly planned military operation, and in the sense that they were able to go in and release the hostages with only minor casualties among the hostages, far more than they had a right to anticipate. Luck was very much with them that night. Then it was tactically a success. It was a success also in the sense that at a time when nations appeared to be helpless against doing anything against terrorists, helpless in dealing with the terrorist threat, one nation was seen to do something, and to do so successfully. If, on the other hand, you judge success in terms of as a means of deterring future terrorist acts, or as a means of handling all such incidents, then I'm afraid there's no such success. The success is limited to the one-time episode. And you can't do too many of those things and expect to carry them off. That's the kind of thing that maybe works once, perhaps twice, but you can't repeatedly storm it and expect the people to remain totally unaware and not to take some precautions against it. So as a deterrent, probably not. As a standard operational response to terrorism, probably not. As a worthwhile idea of simply sending invading military forces to rescue hostages, probably not. Historically, 78% of all hostages who are killed in international hostage episodes are killed during the rescue by security forces. Indeed, if I'm ever in the unfortunate position of being held hostage, the last damn thing I want to see in the world is somebody trying to come and rescue me, because I know that my life expectancy has just gone down sharply. But in terms of a move in a sense that was itself choreographed, that captured the world's attention, the number of movies and novels that it has provoked, that demonstrated that nations are not entirely helpless in dealing with terrorist attacks, then probably a success.
Mr. Jenkins was asked to comment on ways of coping with terrorists in terms of the possible internal stability problems of terrorist groups.
I would like to really congratulate you for using the word coping with terrorism, rather than some of the words that are more popularly bandied about, such as eradicating the terrorist threat, cutting out the cancer of terrorism, ending the contagion of terrorism. It's interesting how many terms are used in the context of terrorism that are more appropriately reserved to the fields of epidemiology and public health. And it's an unfortunate analogy because it's misleading. We're not going to be able to wipe out terrorism as one talks about wiping out yellow fever in a canal zone. It's really a matter of combating, coping, dealing with the incidents that do occur effectively. But let me try to address specifically the issue that you talk about in terms of the internal cohesion of terrorist groups. They do have a hell of a problem with this. This is a major cause problem. You have within any single terrorist organization the ideologues who may see the use of terrorist tactics as simply a tool that they use to achieve their goals. But within the same organization, there will be the thugs, the pathological killers, for whom dedication to the violence is the primary reason for them being in the group. And they can change organization or they can change banners, but really they're thugs and shooters and they can go about anywhere. So there is continuously a degree of tension within any large terrorist group between whether you term it the hardliners versus the moderates, or whether you term it in terms of the ideologue leaders versus the bombers and shooters. They really have discovered no secrets for coping with this internally any more than any other organization has. Their leaders are vulnerable to being called traitors if they don't go along with the most extreme operations. The organization itself is vulnerable to fragmentation, and fragmentation frequently occurs. We've seen it occur numerous times in both the IRA and in the Palestinian movement, where the group becomes big and a group splinters off. To a certain extent, that may provide some utility for governments faced with this. They may attempt to exploit that. In some cases, it's to their advantage that the groups fragment. In some cases, it may well be to a government's disadvantage. The government may want to maintain a certain degree of cohesion. Let me exemplify that with an anecdote drawn not from strictly a terrorist incident, but an incident that many of you probably are familiar with, took place in Washington, D.C. a while ago. That's the Hanafi Muslim episode, in which we had three separate groups holding hostages at three locations in Washington. The B'nai B'rith office building, the district building, and the Muslim center. A decision had to be made at the time whether or not they would cut off the leader of the group, Khalees, from the other two locations. And a decision was made that it wouldn't be a good idea because, in a sense, that would isolate the other two groups. And they were considered, in one case, particularly at the district building where they had already killed someone, more dangerous if isolated. And the use of the leadership, in this case Khalees, as the moderating element was judged valuable enough to try and keep him in charge. Now take that incident, apply it to say something like the Palestinians. It may well be in the interests of an ultimate peaceful solution in the Middle East not to undermine the leadership of, say, a Yasser Arafat. I'm not going to suggest that as a policy. I'm offering it as a hypothetical. Given that the absence of a Yasser Arafat is likely to result in a splintering of the organization, but then the splinters become less controllable and more dangerous to overall society. So it is potentially a strategy. It is a vulnerability of the terrorist groups that can be exploited, but one has to make decisions about when to use that sort of a tool and when not to.
One questioner wanted to know if Mr. Jenkins thought there was a relationship between the amount of arms held by private citizens in a country and the amount of terrorism in that country.
Well, it would be difficult to really draw a good correlation between private citizens possessing weapons and terrorism. Take a society such as Germany, West Germany, where the gun control is extremely, extremely tight, and yet they have some of the most virulent terrorist groups. Unfortunately, arms are available in enough parts of the world and can be gotten across borders so that it becomes no terrorist group that I know of is having a serious shortage of weapons. They don't have an arms shortage. On the other hand, we are perhaps one of the most heavily armed, in terms of our private citizenry, heavily armed countries in the world, and yet our level of terrorism is not comparable to that, say, of Italy or of Argentina or Northern Ireland or even of West Germany. That's not an argument against gun control. I have some personal views about a lot of weapons in the hands of private citizens for totally other reasons. But you can't make a strong argument either way when you're talking about political extremists. They managed to get their weapons.
Another questioner asked if there was any general solution to terrorism.
I don't think we're really going to stop it. I mean, you can make a law against it. In terms of laws, though, we have enough laws on the books. The question is enforcement. The question is not enforcement within the country, but the question is enforcement internationally. The problem internationally is that terrorism is not defined by laws, it's defined by political point of view. And so long as it's defined by political view, and so long as it affects the nations of the world unequally, then one is going to have not the full enthusiastic support of all the nations of the world in combating it. Indeed, up till now, the international response to terrorism has been feeble. Certainly, there are some concrete things that can be done. We are accustomed in this country to tight airport security. That is not universally the case throughout the world. Countries probably can cooperate more than they have in the area of exchanging information, of apprehending known terrorists, of extraditing terrorists. Those are international steps that can be taken. Unilaterally, I think we can improve our capabilities of responding effectively to acts of terrorism that may occur. And this is very, very important. I think it's not only important that the government be competent, but also be seen to be competent in dealing with a terrorist episode. Because the consequences of incompetence here is increased public alarm. And increased public alarm brings about the increased fear and the clamor for the draconian solutions. And that is really the serious danger, at least to me, that terrorists pose in the repression they breed. And it's not that government is waiting in the wings with a set of draconian measures to impose upon the population against an unwitting population. It is frequently the case that the public demands such measures be imposed because of a clamor for immediate security. A government that cannot provide its citizens with the security, that looks incompetent in dealing with these crises, invites further challenge, and as I say, increases the alarm, and the consequences of that are dangerous. So I think we can equip ourselves to deal with these competently when they do occur. Certainly, in the area of intelligence, there is probably more that can be done. And I'm not talking about black bag operations. I'm not talking about illegal operations. I'm talking about pure intelligence. Our intelligence community, in a natural reaction to the abuses of the Vietnam era and to the abuses of the Watergate era, passed some legislation which has had some unwitting side effects in terms of hurting some of the intelligence agencies. I don't mean that feds should get to have wiretaps whenever they want. But let me give you an interesting example. The Hanafis, before the raid in Washington, D.C., collected 42 weapons, including automatic weapons, and 16,000 rounds of ammunition. Today, if somebody were to collect information on a group, a political extremist group, religious group, gathering automatic weapons and 16,000 rounds of ammunition, if anybody were to collect information on that, they would be in violation of those persons' rights, according to the current law. We cannot collect that kind of information. I say we. I'm not talking about me personally. I'm talking about the legally constituted intelligence agencies. We have new guidelines for the collection of foreign intelligence, including Executive Order 11905. This was written to limit some of the wrong activities of the intelligence community. Same time, it, interestingly enough, it places limitations on the collection of intelligence. It makes a specific exemption for those involved in international terrorist activities, but nowhere in the document does it define terrorist activities and what they are. Since no one knows, the thing is subject to interpretation. Since it's subject to interpretation, some officials are inclined to overinterpret it, some are inclined to interpret the thing perhaps too cautiously. Certainly, not saying that these measures, whether Privacy Act, Freedom of Information Act, Executive Order 11905, ought to be rescinded. They ought not to be. They have a good purpose. But in many cases, the legislation was drafted hastily, in a heated emotional climate, and it's had some unwitting effects that even the drafters of this legislation haven't quite figured out. Well, gee, we didn't intend to do that. We intended to stop this. And they've done that instead. So there's things that can be done there. So basically, increasing security, enforcing those laws that exist, having good intelligence is really the only measure of protection against these incidents when they do occur, having the ability to react competently when incidents occur, and somehow enlisting greater international cooperation would be the five areas I would concentrate on, not looking for any panacea, just looking for a measure here and a measure there. Okay, thank you again very much.
Brian Jenkins, Director of Research on International Terrorism for the RAND Corporation and author of International Terrorism, A New Mode of Conflict.